Welcome back. I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The debate about the fairness of the tax code and how much should be paid has been reignited this week by the Republicans running for president. If you've listened to even a few minutes of news this week, you probably know that Mitt Romney paid an effective tax rate of 13.9% in 2010. His rate is lower than most taxpayers because most of his income comes from capital gains on investments. Under the U.S. tax code, capital gains are taxed at 15% compared with a top tax rate of 35% for wage earners. Romney released his tax records on Tuesday, showing he will pay $6 million in taxes on a total of $45 million from income. He also has money in a Swiss bank account. There's also been a lot of coverage of his tenure at Bain Capital and the money that he's still receiving from that work. Now, this was a perfect opportunity for the media to really focus on the tax system and to explore the connection between taxes and revenues. So, how did they do? In about 10 minutes, we'll be joined by David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist who's been covering taxes for many years. And we're also joined by Eric Regulli. He's the European business correspondent for the Globe and Mail, and he has been busily writing about the economic crisis in Europe. And one of his latest pieces is about a trucker's blockade that has squeezed Rome. And Eric joins us from Rome. Hi, Eric. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rose. Nice to be on again.
It's great to have you on again. So as we always do on Friday, Eric, we like to start off on a positive note, as you know, and give kudos to a reporter who did a good job this week. So where did you see reporting that was done well this week?
Rose, I'm going to cheat a little bit. I was really happy with a New Yorker article, and I'm cheating because the New Yorker article actually wasn't this week. It was a couple weeks ago, but we all know the New Yorker. It's something you don't have to read right away. It sort of lingers around the house for a few weeks. It was called No Exit. It was by Philip Gurevich. I don't know if I pronounced that correctly. And it was a really in-depth piece about Nicolas Sarkozy, the president of France. And why I was interested in this story is that Sarkozy, of course, faces re-election, but also economically, he's the first president since World War II to lose the country's credit rating. They got downgraded from AAA to AA by Standard & Poor's the other day, and it could cost him his job. And this piece, which has got to be at least 10 pages long, goes into the economic challenges that France faces. It's actually not in much better shape than Italy. And also, how he's caught between the right and the left now that he's become a target. So I found it really good because I don't know. It was a slam dunk last year that Sarkozy would win the March election. It's no longer assured.
And so when is the election in France?
It's going to be in March. And Nicolas Sarkozy was polling high. He's come down quite substantially. A couple of recent polls have the Socialist Party, which is run by François Hollande, polling higher than him. Also, Marine Le Pen, who is on the extreme right, is polling fairly high. She's about 20%. So, you know, it looks like if he doesn't win outright, there could be a runoff vote, or he could even lose, which would be an extraordinary story given that he has built himself as the supreme and the ultimate good manager of the French economy.
Lose to which side? Of course, that's the big question. How are the did the article give you any sense of how people in France are feeling right now?
Well, it did. I mean, they're shocked that that France has been hit as hard as it has been hit by the debt crisis. I know you want to talk about this later on, but France and Germany were the two countries that were supposed to be immune from the debt crisis, that were supposed to solve the problems in Europe, not be part of the problems. And France now has gone from part of the solution to the debt crisis to part of the problem. It's lost its credit rating. Its unemployment rate's going up. Manufacturing is going down. It's at extreme odds with Angela Merkel of Germany and how to cure the debt crisis. For example, France believes in these common euro bonds, which would pool the the risk for all the Eurozone countries. And Angela Merkel of Germany is dead set against it. So you've got that tension going on as well, which is also discussed in this article.
And what are some of the main reasons behind this? What's the unemployment rate in France right now?
I can tell you because the numbers just came out. It is rising. The French unemployment rate is now 9.8%, but 24% youth unemployment, which is very, very high. Youth unemployment is under age 25. Those figures, believe it or not, Rose, are worse than Italy. Italy's unemployment rate is only 8.6% versus 9.8% for France. So it's funny how Italy is considered a total basket case. But on many measures, it's doing as good or better than France, which is not considered a basket case. I mean, just it's fascinating to me how these countries are evolving in terms of risk.
And then I was reading your tweets this morning. You write that the Spanish unemployment rate among people under 25 is almost 50%. That's worse than Greece.
Yes, this is. Now, I suspect that figure, 49.6%, is probably under-exaggerated. It's probably a little bit higher. The national unemployment rate is 23%. Youth unemployment is almost 50%. To me, Rose, this is a grenade ready to go off this country. You cannot have 50% unemployment for long without social unrest. Mm. Social unrest so far has hit Britain, France to some degree, certainly Greece, a little bit Italy, but not so much Spain. I think that's going to change this year. It's also going to hurt the Spanish government very much because it's got an austerity program going on that's very aggressive under this new conservative government. And more likely, the unemployment rate's going to go up. I mean, if you're cutting jobs, cutting spending, cutting welfare, social insurance, unemployment benefits, the rate has to go up. So I think there's a real problem there.
You also report on the trucker strike in Italy. It's cutting food supplies to Rome. You say that your local market is already half shut down. So what is all of this look like in the media? How are the European press really covering this crisis?
Well, it's funny, the Italian trucker strike did not get a lot of publicity outside of Italy. And my take on this is that strikes are so routine in Italy. It's considered the country of strikes and ho-hum, we've got another strike in Italy. Every day, every newspaper has a list of who's on strike. Today, public transportation and trains were on strike. I mean, I had a lot of trouble getting my kids to and from school today. The trucker strike is pretty much over. I noticed that there is more food in the supermarkets today, but didn't get a lot of publicity outside of Italy, and it surprised me because this is the beginning of the pushback against the austerity and economic reform programs of Mario Monti. He's the man who replaced Silvio Berlusconi 3 months ago, and if this intensifies, it could wreck his economic reform package.
Well, this isn't getting any coverage here. I didn't even know about this until I read your piece. But the cruise ship is still getting a lot of coverage in the U.S.
Well, because it makes a great picture, right?
Right.
I've been writing a lot about that. I think this, the strikes, the food shortages, the gasoline shortages everywhere, a much bigger story. Because why is it a bigger story? Because if Italy sinks, Europe's finished. I mean, Greece is 3% of Eurozone gross domestic product. It's nothing. Italy is about 20%. If Italy goes down, Europe goes down. If Europe goes down, the world goes back. You have a global recession, maybe depression. So it matters here. I don't understand why it's not getting more publicity.
Well, are those realities reflected in the coverage?
Yes and no. Like I said, this last week got very little coverage, the strikes and the anti-austerity protests. And one person was killed in them, and there was several people injured, and it got very little publicity. I just think that, the cruise ship was the dominant story in Italy the last couple of weeks, and that, it's still big. It's what people want. It was an easy story to understand. I also sense that Europeans and North Americans getting a bit sick of this European debt crisis. We're now in the third year, and it's very hard to understand. There's too many moving parts, and it's crisis fatigue. That's what's happening.
Well, I'd love to hear listeners on this. Do you think that there's crisis fatigue here? Do you know what is going on in Europe? What do you make of the coverage that you're reading about the economic crisis in Europe? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. If you have any questions for Eric Regeli, who's the European business correspondent for the Globe and Mail, we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org, or better yet, post a comment on our new website, yourcallradio.org. What about Davos? What's happening right now at the World Economic Forum? Are these issues being raised there? And with so much attention, usually the media spends a lot of time writing about what happens at the World Economic Forum. Are they infusing these troubles into the stories? Are you reading much about capitalism?
I am. There's the bog standard is panels and discussions about is capitalism in trouble. I saw a couple debates on the BBC. I mean, most of them are pretty boring. I found one interesting with Nouriel Roubini out of New York. I mean, he's probably the only economist who anticipated the financial crisis. One of few, I shouldn't say the only one. And I found that one interesting. And his point was, how do you define capitalism? You know, what sort of capitalism is in trouble? I mean, there's state capitalism like China. There's social democracy like Europe. There's American-style capitalism. There's, you know, regulated and unregulated capitalism. So I found that fairly interesting. The other stuff out of Davos, again, I didn't find that thrilling. There was some news about the Greek bond restructuring, which is the big story out of Greece at the moment. They're trying to crunch the value of those bonds by about 50%. Otherwise, you know, Rose, I didn't get very excited about it. I think the Davos summit is getting very tired, very old.
Mm. Well, Eric, what questions do you think reporters should be asking when they interview these leaders? And there have been a lot of interviews this week with people at Davos, with people who have a lot of money, for example, investors on Wall Street, investors in London. What questions should reporters be asking?
Well, if I were asking, I mean, many of the leaders have been in Davos, and Stephen Harper of Canada, Christine Lagarde of the IMF, David Cameron, the Prime Minister of Britain. I mean, they're all there. Matteo Monti of Italy. I would ask these guys this. I would say, why are you guys such masochists? These austerity programs are the equivalent of medieval torture. Mm. They're killing these economies. And as these economies get crunched more and more through these austerity programs and cutbacks and tax increases, it's a vicious circle. It in turn requires more austerity because these budget deficits don't go away. And I just think that their solution is for the wrong problem. It's not really a debt crisis here. You know, it's called a debt crisis. So I would ask them, you know, why the punishment and where has it gotten you? I mean, everyone would now admit that the Greek austerity programs have completely and utterly failed after 2 years and, you know, a couple $100 billion. So that's probably the main question I would ask.
And so I'm assuming that question is not being asked then.
Well, it is, but not very aggressively. I mean, especially to Angela Merkel, the Chancellor of Germany. I mean, she will admit that Greece is not getting any better, but she is, you know, effectively in charge of these bailouts. She is effectively in charge of the European Central Bank because, you know, it's the old Bundesbank in disguise. And she will not allow the bank to buy in any quantity the debt of these countries to bring down the interest rates. So I think that the questioning of her should be more aggressive because after 2 years, this debt crisis started almost 2.5 years ago. Nothing much has improved. The banks are in better shape than they were because of these massive liquidity injections last month under Mario Draghi. But, you know, the economies are not getting any better at all.
Well, we have a few callers on this, so let's hear from Kevin in Oakland. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you. Just a couple of quick points. As far as coverage goes, I think I read the Financial Times, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, and the London Guardian, and they've all covered this very aggressively.
Oh, Kevin, can you not hear? Right? Kevin, can you not hear?
No,
I'm sorry, Rose, Eric. You can't hear Kevin.
Kevin at all. Maybe you could repeat.
Okay, can you hear him now? Kevin, go ahead.
I guess my point was that the two points. One is that the New York Times, the Financial Times, Wall Street Journal, the London Guardian have all covered the crisis very aggressively. And so they've all been asking the right questions, particularly of the Germans, and why European governments continue to allow the crisis to continue without aggressive response. So I'm not sure whether there hasn't been aggressive coverage. You know, obviously, maybe the Daily Mail isn't covering it aggressively, but the serious newspapers are. My second point about the French is that this summer, while I was in Paris, Sarkozy's election prospects were much worse. And in fact, in recent polls, Sarkozy is pulling much closer to the socialists. He's distancing himself from Le Pen. And it's becoming more likely, in the French commentary at least, that he's going to be reelected, which is shocking given his unpopularity, his personal unpopularity. But the French people seem to be shifting more in his favor, largely because of the weakness of the socialist candidate rather than Sarkozy's programs themselves. So I just think the analysis that France presented here today is absolutely wrong. And it's wrong because it's interesting, really, how well Sarkozy is doing in recent polls. But again, largely because, not because of his response to the crisis, but because of the weakness of the socialist candidate. And I'll take my comments off the air.
All right. Thank you for calling, Kevin. Eric, you heard Kevin.
Yeah, Kevin, I mean, good points, but I mean, these polls are all over the map. The latest poll I saw was had the socialists polling very high. I don't know if it was actually higher than Sarkozy. The one point I will make is that, you know, 3 months, well, 2 points, 3 months is a long time, more than 2 months for the election. That's a long time. Sarkozy could very well win for the simple reason that Dominique Strauss-Kahn, who would have been the socialist candidate, of course, got caught up in that sex scandal in New York a few months ago and has vanished from the French political map. So DSK is absolutely no threat to him any longer. I still think that Sarkozy's re-election is not absolutely assured. It could be a runoff vote.
All right. Thank you for calling in, Kevin. Let's go next to Carol. Hi, Carol. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
I just have a question about something to do with the French economy, and it's about the fact, I think, that they were going to supply nuclear power to China, and maybe after Fukushima, China backed out of the deal and nuclear is on hold. I think maybe that has something to do with the French economy having problems right now. Is that true?
Eric?
You know, again, a good question. I'm afraid of either lying to you or looking stupid because I don't know a lot about it other than that the French nuclear industry is enormous by global standards. And it's one of their major exporters. And if nuclear power ceases being such a great export generator for France, it would hurt their economy. You know, most of the electricity in France is actually generated by nuclear power. But I'm going to stop there because I don't know enough about it. I'm sorry.
Okay. Well, thank you for saying that you don't know enough about it. Obviously, you can't know everything about what's happening in France. But we'll look for a couple of articles, Carol, and we'll put a few links on our website at yourcallradio.org. Thanks for calling. Let's go next to Max in Berkeley. Hi, Max.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for a good program. Number of comments. The UK Guardian, Le Monde, El País, Financial Times, they all have covered these issues, I think, quite well, asking the right questions. And specifically regarding France, I think Sarkozy in some trouble. And there's some people getting very nervous about Le Pen's party. And... The numbers are disturbing some people. And Le Pen's daughter is I would think, quite a capable campaigner. And you have to put it in a European context. I think the right is on the rise all over Europe, specifically in Hungary. There's more than a whiff of fascism coming out of there. And you look at what's happening in Greece and in Portugal and formerly in Spain. The parties of the left have been managing austerity with disastrous results for the left in general. In Spain, the Socialist Party lost big time. And the Popular Party is in power. And, of course, they are introducing more austerity, imposing more austerity on the Spanish people. As for France and the nuclear power, your guest is quite right. Nuclear power represents, what, at least 75% of electricity production in France. However, it's interesting that more and more the Socialist parties and the Greens in France are questioning nuclear power. As a matter of fact, Mr. Hollande just proposed that the share of nuclear power be reduced to something like 50% by 2025. I don't know how realistic that is, but it is being questioned. But it's a huge industry in France that historically has enjoyed the support of all parties from the far left to the far right. But the situation is mixed, and I think it's very well covered in the major European newspapers. El País has had all sorts of articles on the rise of Rajoy, the new prime minister who represents the right in Spain. So it's being covered there, perhaps not here. Anyway, thank you for a good program.
Okay, thank you for that, Max. Eric?
Yeah, I think the caller made a good point about the rise of the conservative and conservative governments throughout Europe and the rise of some very radical right-wing politicians. And this is what worries me a lot in Europe. As these economies deteriorate, which they are, you get finger pointing, and the finger pointing is at immigrants. Immigrants are stealing our jobs. Mm-hmm. Our unemployment rate's too high. Let's get rid of the immigrants. And you know, it's in across Europe and Italy as well. The Northern League, which is still the second most powerful party in Italy. He was the Northern League was an alliance with Silvio Berlusconi's party. I mean, they're openly xenophobic. They don't want immigration at all, and they blame Italy for many of the problems. Immigrants for many of the problems here. So this is my big worry here as these economies go from bad to worse.
And Eric, what are you working on right now? Just quickly.
What am I working on right now is I'm waiting for the Greek bond deal to get done. It should happen the next 2-3 days. This will crunch the privately held bond debt by 50%. Why I'm interested in the story is that if the deal fails, and it could fail, then Greece would not get its second bailout because the bond crunch is a condition of the second bailout worth $130 billion. And if this deal isn't done, there's a very good chance of a Greek default in an uncontrolled manner, and that could just wreak havoc economically, financially across Europe.
Well, Eric, thank you so much for joining us, and we'll have you back in a couple of weeks. Eric Reguli is European business correspondent with The Globe and Mail, and when we come back, we'll talk about coverage of taxes with David K. Johnston. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
You're listening to Your Call on listener-supported KALW San Francisco, supported in part by folks like Paul Mueller of Oakland, who renewed his membership at KALW.org and comments, best station ever. Thanks for having the pledge drive without program interruptions. So refreshing not to be preached at. We do respect your intelligence here at KALW, and that's why we're counting on you to make this quiet, interruption-free January membership drive a success. We'll keep the drive as brief as possible, but please make that first-time pledge, renew your membership, or offer us an additional gift at KALW.org right now. And thanks for your support.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. You can find more information about the show at yourcallradio.org. You can leave a comment there and sign up for our newsletter to find out what's coming up. On Monday, we'll have a conversation with David Weinberger about his new book, Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge Now That the Facts Are Not the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the smartest person in the room is the room. We're also putting shows together next week about redevelopment, the shutting down of redevelopment agencies in California, what's working in our schools, and Nigeria. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, it's our Friday Media Roundtable, and we're going to now talk about coverage of austerity and taxes and the budgets in the U.S. And joining us to talk about that is David K. Johnston, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist and author. David is a columnist at Reuters. He teaches tax, property, and regulatory law of the ancient world at Syracuse University College of Law. He's author of Free Lunch, and he's a 13-year veteran of the New York Times, where he covered taxes, loopholes, and inequities. Hi, David. Welcome back to the show.
Sorry I wasn't available as promised at the start of the hour. Sometimes work gets in the way.
Oh, no problem. We understand. We were talking with Eric Regulli, the European business correspondent for the Globe and Mail, about, well, in his words, how bad things are. I mean, every time he comes on, he says Greece is about to fall or Italy is about to fall. But he also talks about austerity and how it's killing Europe across the board. And you have a video on Reuters called The Case Against Austerity. And I'm wondering, what do you think about coverage of austerity in the U.S.?
Well, I think it's just awful. And I think that I do hope people go to Reuters.com. I hope the video is still on the right side down the page with two little icons of an engine. Simple economic rule. On a worldwide basis, spending equals income and income equals spending. If everybody has less income, there has to be less spending. If there's less spending, there has to be less income. So when people's incomes are down, the only way to avoid less spending is for government to somehow intervene. If government spends more, then there will be more income. Now, in the long run, you want government to levy about what it taxes. It doesn't have to be perfect because some of government spending is long-term investments and things that pay off over a long period of time. But it needs to be reasonably close. We haven't been in that situation for years. And unfortunately, we've gone off on this path of borrowing. When Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980, he promised a balanced budget in 3 years, never attained it. Bill Clinton balanced the budget the last 2 years he was in office, and this was immediately undone by the next administration, which doubled the government debt. And when Obama came in, we were in this terrible situation where we had these record deficits that are now coming down, and if he had not given in to the Republicans on extending all of the Bush tax cuts for two more years, we would be on quite a path toward a balanced budget. But cutting government spending means more people will lose their jobs and people will be worse off.
Yet it's rarely framed like that in the media.
Well, that's because most reporters never took a course in economics, and if they did, they don't understand it. Household economics is not government economics. If you lose your job, you've got to cut your spending or consume your savings. Governments are different, and America has monopoly control of its currency, so it can never go broke. We could go broke in theory, but it can never go broke. The Greeks are in trouble because their tax system is more whole than tax, and they are under the euro. And the reason the Germans and the French have been putting up money to rescue Greece to some degree is because if they went back to separate currencies, the Deutsche Mark would rise tremendously in value, and the Germans would sell fewer Siemens computers and fewer Airbus jets, which they partly make, and fewer Mercedes-Benz and BMW cars.
So here we are, David, the Republican debates, gosh, 18 or 19 of them already. You've got Republicans calling each other venture capitalists. They're talking about inequality, forcing Mitt Romney to release his tax returns. What is the real story here? You could not turn on the radio this week without, or even the television, without hearing about Mitt Romney's tax returns. What's the real story?
Well, the most important story is that Mr. Romney needs to release his returns since 1984 so we can see what happened during the years that he ran Bain Capital. I have a column that will go up. That's why I was off, couldn't get online with you. A column going up shortly about the fact that most Americans think you can only give your children $10 million before you have to pay gift and estate taxes, and that's just not true. If you're in Romney's position, you can give unlimited amounts of money, and he's given his children enough money that they've got $100 million in the trust fund, but the actual gift was valued at less than $2 million. By the way, we also need to see Gingrich's returns back to the year after he left Congress. And the standard for this was set by George Romney in the 60s when he released 12 years of returns because he said two things. It's the right thing to do, and 1 year could be a fluke. The Romney campaign has stopped responding to my emails, and I've heard on one broadcast station that they told them we're not going to take any more questions about his finances. I think that's awful, and I think that Gingrich should have to explain. And by the way, under Newt Gingrich's tax plan, Romney's taxes would drop to virtually zero.
Right.
And under Romney's tax plan, 28% of the tax savings would go to the roughly 1 in 500 Americans who makes more than $1 million a year.
Well, and I'd love to know if listeners are hearing this in the extensive coverage about this issue. What do you make of the coverage about taxes? Do you think the media are asking the right questions? Are they really exploring our tax system and talking about how it's connected, obviously, to revenues and the budget? And What's the real story here? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org. We're speaking with David K. Johnston, columnist with Reuters and author of the book Free Lunch. Now, David, what was interesting to me is when I heard about this, you know, a lot of people are thinking, oh, did Romney break the law? Well, no, he didn't break the law because the capital gains, the income on capital gains on investment is taxed at 15%. But that fact was missing from a lot of the pieces that I heard and read this week.
It was. And a lot of people also think because there are these funds in the Cayman Islands, he's done something illegal. Absolutely not. There is nothing nefarious about it. And let me just quickly explain how that works. Romney got people to invest in a partnership. Ordinary Americans and who invest in it, they just put money into it. But if you're a foreigner, you're an Italian or a Japanese, you don't want to invest directly. You'd have to file an American tax return. So you instead invest in a Cayman Islands company, which then invests in Romney's deal. If you are an American pension fund, a college endowment, or other charitable endowment, and you invest in the fund, you will be taxed because they use borrowed money to create leverage. So you invest in the same Cayman Islands company, and it then does the investing, and you're exempted from that rule. Romney gets a share of the profits from successful deals, and even though he left the company in 99, he made an arrangement. He still gets paid. Wouldn't you like that if you left KALW and you could keep getting paid for the rest of your life? And so part of that money, whatever share came from pension funds, charitable endowments, and offshore individuals, is run through the Cayman Islands simply to avoid their being entangled with American tax rules. There's nothing improper about it. The law may need to be fixed.
Right.
You don't like the law. But Romney, as best I can tell, has complied with the law. He didn't, however, release his full tax returns, even for the years in question. The trust returns contain statements. The income tax return has 69 pages of explanations of what's in the tax return. And the attached statements for the trust returns were excluded.
And then the reason why the capital gains tax on investments is so low is because George W. Bush brought it down, right?
Well, first it was brought down under Clinton. Clinton brought it down from 28 to 20,
okay,
8 cents on the dollar. And then under Bush, it was brought down to 15%. So the Clinton cut was actually much bigger than the Bush cut.
So, see, this is what's so important. So under Clinton... So then under, so 28 to 20% and then down to 15%. I mean,
so
these
13
are...
13 cent, almost a half cut. 14 percentage points would have been half. It was almost cut in half.
Yeah, this seems like such an important detail.
It's a very important detail, but here's the thing to think about. How many journalists do you think, excluding the big name talent on television, have dividends?
Uh-huh. Probably most of them. Well, let's go to a caller on this. Let's hear from Greg in Palo Alto. Hi, Greg.
Hello, thanks. I'm turning my radio down, sorry.
Thanks.
Just a brief comment first about the European issue, and then I wanted to ask Mr. Johnson a question. Europe may be in as bad a shape as your reporter from Europe was indicating, but I just still find it really odd that these private rating companies in the United States, which gave AAA ratings to the banks and financial institutions in the United States prior to the meltdown, which they were the cause of, still have credibility in giving ratings to governments in Europe. So it never ceases to amaze me about that. But the other question I had for him was this. I checked on Google the other day. I was trying to get some information about the kind of income that the state of California was deriving from capital gains as opposed to income tax. And although I couldn't get complete information, I wanted to ask him a question. If I'm hearing you correctly, what's really clear is that the tax system is so skewed to the rich that it's absolutely incredible. And if you look at unearned income, I mean, income that doesn't get derived from wages and salaries, it's phenomenal how regressive the tax system is with regard to capital gains and unearned income, as opposed to the income tax on wages and salaries. So people are really being duped in this country. They don't understand that people who are working, making a salary or being paid a salary and wages, are being taxed far more than people who are deriving their income from investments. And it's amazing how the people have been able to get away with this, and people don't understand that that tax system is so skewed. If you had a progressive capital gains tax and a progressive tax on unearned income, I don't think we'd be in the situation we're in today. And I'd love to hear what Mr. Johns would have to say about that.
All right, thank you, Greg. David?
Okay. Very good points by the caller, and I agree with him. I don't think there's any credibility in the ratings of the bond agencies who get paid by the companies issuing the debt instead of by the customers, which was how it was done before the invention of the Xerox machine, the Xerox 941 back in 1959. And by the way, my point about journalists was most of them don't have any dividends. They don't have two nickels to rub together. Therefore, they don't understand everything the caller was just talking about, how the rich are taxed differently. Congress has created two tax systems in America, separate and unequal. One is for wage earners. They're not trusted. Their taxes are taken out of their checks before they get paid. Everything they report virtually is verified by independent sources, employers, banks, mortgage lenders. Wealthy business people, Congress trusts them to honestly report their taxes, and unless you're audited, there's no verification of most of your income. If you get your income as capital, that is dividends or capital gains, which are highly concentrated, 10,000 people in a country of 312 million get a third of the capital gains, 10,000. If you get your income in capital gains, you're taxed very, very lightly. And if you are smart about it, you can use offsetting losses, and everybody has losses, to collect those capital gains without paying them. And one of the reasons companies don't pay dividends like they used to, blue chip companies used to pay 5, 6, 8% dividends. Mm-hmm. Now many of them pay nothing, is because as long as you don't pay a dividend, the money should cause the value of the stock to rise. And very wealthy people, if you have $1 billion of stock, you can go to Goldman Sachs and they'll loan you money against that at 2% a year. That's a lot cheaper than paying even a 15% tax, and you don't owe any income taxes.
Did President Reagan raise the capital gains tax rate from 20 to 28% in 1986?
Yes, he did, and he raised business taxes too. And the research shows that we're being fed something that is untrue by the corporations pushing for a lower tax rate. They all keep citing studies showing that if you cut the corporate tax rate, there'll be economic growth. Well, those studies only apply to poor countries that have terrible tax systems where they don't tax all businesses, just the big ones they can identify. If you look just at the data from the 34 modern economies that belong to the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, and I wrote a column about this recently, the data show that there will be almost no effect. The issue in corporate taxation is that we have this very complicated system where some people win and some people lose. Some companies actually get to collect corporate taxes as an add-on to the prices they charge and keep them. These are regulated monopolies. And in many cases, they never have to give that tax to the government. And in some cases that I've written about where they're partnerships, they don't have to they don't even owe the tax, but the government lets them collect it from customers. So they make profits off taxes.
We're speaking with David K. Johnston, longtime tax reporter, columnist with Reuters, author of a book about these very issues, Free Lunch, How the Wealthiest Americans Enrich Themselves at Government Expense and Stick You with the Bill. We've got about 10 minutes left, so if you have any questions or comments for David, if you'd like to talk about the coverage you've seen or heard on this week, what stories would you like to see on taxes? What do you think is missing from the conversation? If there was another story you saw this week that you'd like to talk about, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also leave a comment at yourcallradio.org or email feedback@yourcallradio.org. All right, so President Reagan raises the capital gains tax rate from 20 to 28% in 1986. And Newt Gingrich says he would bring it all the way down to 0% and tax the rest of us at 15%. He says he'd call it the Mitt Romney flat tax. So, David, if you were an editor at, say, NPR or a newspaper, what story would you assign to a reporter on this issue?
How much revenue would that bring in compared to the government's spending? Americans had about $8 billion of income, and let's assume you tax every penny of it, even poor people, on the first dollar they make have to pay taxes. Well, you're going to take in $1.2 trillion, it would appear. Actually, the income tax today is taking in less than that. In fact, it's taking in less than it was when George W. Bush took office, despite the bigger population in this country. And then I would raise the question of, well, this won't finance the government because you're not going to be able to collect from everybody. And in fact, Gingrich's plan has a floor, and he would exempt all capital income. So you're really going to collect in the hundreds of millions of dollars. How are you going to finance just the military? Forget about everything else. How are you going to finance the military? You're not. How are you going to pay the interest on the national debt, which is now almost $500 billion a year? This is just a fantasy. It appeals to audiences of people. Hey, lower taxes. That sounds great. I'd like to pay lower taxes. I'll bet you would too. But that's not real. It's childish.
What about, again, just bringing up some history here. I brought this article up last week, but Mike Lofgren, a former Republican congressional staffer who says that the GOP is descending into lunacy, wrote a piece for the Nieman Watchdog and said that most reporters don't know that during the Eisenhower administration, the top marginal rate was 91%, and then it was 70% for the following two decades or so, and capital gains were usually taxed as ordinary income. That lack of perspective, he writes, distorts a whole range of popular assumptions about social equity now versus, say, the 1950s.
Yep. In fact, the share of the economy going to federal taxes in 2011 was the smallest it had been since 1952.
Wow.
During the Reagan, Bush, Clinton years, the federal taxes ranged from a little under 18% to 21%. Under Obama, they've been under 15% every year.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if your view is the less you tax, the better the president you are, the Republicans should all want Barack Obama to be their president.
but that's not
really what this is about. I mean, what we're basically being told is that the people at the top are job creators, and if we don't cut their taxes, they won't create jobs. Well, we've been cutting taxes now for people at the top steadily since 1981, and we cut them enormously in 2001 and 2003. Where are the jobs?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we have enough data. At what point do you say the data show this isn't working? And it seems to me we have more than enough evidence that this theory doesn't work. And by the way, all sorts of people listening may think, well, lower taxes mean more growth. Actually, there's quite a bit of evidence that higher taxes mean more growth. For several reasons. One of them is if you're a business owner and you pay a 15% tax, it's only a pass-through through a dividend, and you make an extra profit and you take the money out, the cost is very little. And if you take money out of your business, the more money you take out of it, then the fewer jobs there are. If there's a high tax, let's say it was 50%, what would be a profit if you instead reinvest it in the business? Build a new production line, replace old trucks, put up a new factory. Guess what? The government picked up 50% of your cost, and you keep reinvesting in the business and creating more jobs.
Well, we've got full lines, so let's take a couple calls in a row, and then we'll get David's response. Christopher in San Francisco. Hi, welcome to the show. Hi, Christopher. Let's go to Jonathan in Richmond. Hi, Jonathan.
Hi. What about the idea of making the capital gains tax itself progressive, just the way the income tax is?
All right, we'll get a response in just a minute. Let's hear from Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Yes, good morning. Since such a large part of the military budget, since a large part of the debt is the military budget and the military debt, what can be done to make people more aware of that and bring that into the discussion about actually dramatically reducing these bases overseas and the spending on the military?
All right, thank you, Harry. And
Harry, you want to
go ahead? Yeah, sure.
I mean, the answer, I think, to Harry's question is real simple. So long as we have a volunteer military that draws a lot of its ranks from the poor, most people aren't going to care.
Mm.
They're going to have a totally different view. Somebody who came of age in the 60s and early 70s, I think we need to go back to having a draft. You know, it used to be that 2/3 of the graduating class at Harvard and Princeton got drafted. And if we go back to that, I think it would discourage adventurism and would make us think a lot more about whether it's military power or diplomacy that we want to use. After all, it was diplomacy that brought about the end of the Soviet Union more than military power. To Jonathan's question on progressive capital gains, that's sort of what President Obama proposed in the State of the Union, that if you have $1 million income, we're going to have a minimum tax for you of 30%. That will provoke a response where people will come up with more and more devices to try and get around paying capital gains taxes. And that's part of the reason we need fundamental reform. And my column at Reuters all year, I'm going to show ways that we could simplify the tax system, make it fairer, get rid of the gains that are in it through various steps that shouldn't be a hard reach, because many of them used to be in the law and many of them were sponsored by Republicans.
All right, thanks for those calls. Let's hear from Charles in El Cerrito. Hi, Charles. Hi, Charles. Hello, Charles. Let's go to James in Santa Cruz. Hi, James.
Hi. I just heard about Apple making like $13 billion in profit.
Ah,
or something.
Yes.
Why not have a tax structure that, as you invest in this country, put jobs in the United States, that then we kind of, prorate the tax for that company? I mean, so if Apple put $3 billion of that into, manufacturing in our country, then we would somehow give them tax breaks based on that.
Well, thank you for that. David, I don't know if you've been watching this, but your former paper, The New York Times, has done extensive reporting this week on the Foxconn factories where most of the iPhones and the iPads are made in Shenzhen, China, interviewing Apple execs, many off the record, talking about why these jobs cannot be brought back to the U.S., and Apple execs said there's no possible way. But it's been interesting because they pay workers, less than $400 a month. But it's interesting to watch how the media all of a sudden has been reporting extensively on Apple and Foxconn.
Well, yes, Apple has almost $100 billion in cash, and overall non-financial companies in America have more than, on average, have a total of more than $10,000 in cash per American. So there's no lack of capital to invest.
Mm.
But Apple, is a huge company worldwide, but it only has about 40,000 employees in the U.S. I mean, compared to a lot of other big companies and historically big companies, minimal U.S. workforce, highly paid but small. And James, who's from my hometown, Santa Cruz, raises a very good question. Under the World Trade rules, the World Trade Organization's rules that were mostly written by the financier class, we can't do what he wants to do. The president proposed this in his speech, and I've been trying to get from the White House, well, exactly how would you accomplish this given the World Trade Organization rules that we've signed and have agreed to? And they haven't gotten back to me yet, something this administration is not good at doing when it doesn't like the questions. But he raised a very good question. How, basically, in a global economy, how do we keep from everybody going to the mean, which means American workers making less and less and less until they're at the level of workers in China and Vietnam and elsewhere, except for any adjustment to their education level? And this is a real challenge. Nobody's talking about
it. Well, and I'd love for David, we only have a minute left, but Foxconn workers, 16-hour days, they're lucky if they get a day off a month, and they're making less than $400 a month. What are your thoughts on that? And what do you think about Apple's comment that those jobs are never coming back to the U.S.?
This is, in the classic meaning, not the antebellum South meaning, what slavery is.
Mm-hmm.
And technically, you can't do this under the WOTO rules. You're supposed to let people have unions and organize and meet safety conditions. And China and some other countries flaunt them, and we do nothing about it. So we don't have to allow that. It would mean your iPhone would cost more, but we can have rules to change that. But so long as the debate is totally dominated by the financial concerns and tax concerns of the very wealthy, of people like Romney, who's in the top 1% of the top 1%, then we're not going to deal with these issues that affect the vast majority.
And what are you working on right now?
Trying to explain how Romney passed $100 million to his children in a trust when, in without paying any gift tax, when in theory he couldn't have passed more than two.
Wow. Well,
we'll be out later today at Reuters, I hope, if not over the weekend.
We will look for it. As always, thank you, David. We'd love to have you back soon. David K. Johnston is a columnist at Reuters. You can find his latest pieces and his video reports at yourcallradio.org. Thanks, David.
Thank you.
And thanks for your phone calls. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. Thanks for listening. Here's what's coming up on Monday. How do you define knowledge in the digital age? On the next Your Call, we'll have a conversation with David Weinberger, author of Too Big to Know, Rethinking Knowledge Now That the Facts Aren't the Facts, Experts Are Everywhere, and the Smartest Person in the Room is the Room. How has the rapid proliferation of digital technology changed how we access knowledge? Join us at 10 or email feedback at yourcallradio.org. How has your perception of facts and knowledge changed over the years? It's Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or to sign up for our daily podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Raz is on and Ali Budner produced the show. Matt Martin is executive producer. Pete Misick is our web editor and Becca Hoekstra is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer and David Latulipe is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and produced by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org. Hi, this is Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call, asking for your support. 100% of Your Call's funding comes directly from you. We wouldn't be here without you. Based on the emails and phone calls we receive on a daily basis, we know how much you value in-depth conversations, thoughtful dialogue, and a focus on actual solutions. Now, because we don't take money from corporate sponsors, we have an incredible opportunity to go deeper, tackle issues often ignored in the national media, and have a different conversation. Even though so many outlets are cutting back on original content, KALW is growing and taking risks. On Your Call, we go beyond the talking heads, the political horse race in DC, and the sound bites. We still believe in the facts. We believe in the value of having in-depth conversations with a diverse range of voices on everything from the Occupy movement to our vibrant art scene. Your support will keep independent public radio alive and thriving. Thank you.
Hello, welcome to World Have Your Say. Ben James here with a global conversation on the BBC.
If you ask people how much money it would take for them to really not have to worry about money and be fully satisfied, whatever amount of money they have, they'll tell you they need about twice as much.
Do you want to be rich? Maybe you are already, but most of us consider that we're not amongst the very wealthy. There's controversy over £1 million banker's bonus in the UK. Mitt Romney's wealth is a talking point in the US election. A presidential contender in France wants to tax the rich more heavily. Do you begrudge the rich their wealth, but at the same time want to be one of them? Or maybe you're happy with the relatively little you've got. Would you ever consider yourself rich enough? We're on air for the next hour. You can join us.